everyone. Quick note before we get started. Not to be a broken record, but I just want to thank everyone again who has supported the show's Patreon page and ordered the new official podcast Nuanced AF merchandise, which turns out to be kind of flying off the shelves. I also want to mention something that came up the other day. As you know, you can listen to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, just about all the usual places. And someone asked me the other day if I got paid more if people listened on, say, Spotify than somewhere else. Now, that's a totally logical question. And it also made me burst out laughing because, as people might not know, independent podcasters don't make a dime from these platforms. The platforms merely provide access to the show, which is great, but it's not like I or most other podcasters have a business relationship with them. Again, it's an understandable confusion, which is why I wanted to take a moment here and say that if you want to support the podcast via these platforms, one thing you can do is leave a rating or a review, preferably positive. If you want to financially help, you can join the show's Patreon page, of course, at patreon.com/theunspeakable. It gives you lots of perks, including $10 off your first purchase of merchandise. If you sign up at the $10 a month level or higher, if you pay for the whole year up front, you get 2 months free. Anyway, right now, Patreon is my only revenue for this project. So it means so much when people join at any level. I can't emphasize this enough. It's really hard for me to ask for money. When I was a kid, my parents didn't even want me to go trick-or-treating because it was like begging. So I hate having to talk about it here, but I just want to make clear, Spotify is not paying me. I'm not Joe Rogan, though people do get us mixed up all the time. Second and last order of business. If you are on the social media app Clubhouse, I will be hosting a conversation on Thursday, April 1st with Angel Eduardo, who was my guest on the March 7th edition of the podcast. Angel is a writer, a visual artist, and a musician who has a lot to say about the new identitarianism and how it's factored into his life as a millennial with immigrant parents and a relatively working class upbringing. This episode drew a ton of positive attention and people wanted to know more about Angel. So he and I will continue our conversation on Clubhouse on April 1st from 8 to 9:30 Eastern time. If you have no idea what Clubhouse is, just Google it. If you're already on it and you're not totally freaked out by it, this room will be a good one to catch, I think. And with that, let's get to this week's interview.
We're in this very unfortunate environment, right? Where this is not something when I started my academic career I thought I would ever need to know, right? What would I need to do if a mob was howling for my job? But unfortunately, that's the situation we're in, and that people are, in fact, getting harassed and getting threatened, and they need advice then about how best to deal with that.
If you've been following the seemingly constant flow of eruptions on college campuses over free speech, you may have noticed that professors are a frequent target of censorship and complaint. Sometimes it's because students object to what's being taught, and sometimes it's as trivial as a professor sending a tweet or saying something in a non-professional context that students find, and here's that overused but unavoidable word, problematic. A new organization has been formed to help educators navigate these waters. The Academic Freedom Alliance, housed at Princeton University and made up of scholars from across the political spectrum, seeks to protect academic freedom in a variety of ways, including helping provide legal aid to professors and researchers who find themselves accused of wrong speak. Its chair, Keith Whittington, is my guest this week. Keith is a constitutional law scholar and political science professor at Princeton. He spoke with me about why the AFA came about, how academia has changed over the course of his career, and why it's important to remember that speech suppression comes from the political right as well as the activist left, We also talked about why professors are often temperamentally inclined to apologize or even explain themselves when that's often the worst thing you can do when the mob comes after you. Keith Whittington, welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I was hoping you could just tell us about yourself and your background. You're a professor of politics at Princeton. You're also a constitutional law scholar. But I'm curious how you were shaped by academia, both as a student and as a professor. Like, was worrying about what you said ever part of the equation for you?
Unfortunately, yes. Worrying about what I said was part of the equation. Perhaps I should have worried about it more on some occasions.
Well, you made it this far. You're talking to me, so you
yeah, no, exactly. It all worked out in the end. So I don't think I really worried very much about academic freedom as such. I think I mostly took that for granted. Didn't think it was very likely that a mob was going to call for my termination or anything like that. On the other hand, I'm right of center in my own politics. I write about things that are politically salient and that people care about. And as a consequence, I got a lot of pushback in academia as I was coming up. That was more connected to the substance of what I actually did as an academic. And so I always tried to be pretty careful about the kinds of arguments I made and that I thought that they were wholly defensible and that I could stand up to that kind of scrutiny. But there was certainly a lot of scrutiny over time. As a consequence, I think this is sort of an experience of a lot of junior faculty who don't yet have tenure anyway. You're always a little cautious about what it is you're saying because you just don't know how it's going to be received. And in my case, the political dimensions of this being part of a sort of fairly small minority in an academic context was part of the calculation.
So I think you're around my age. When were you in college? Like what era?
So I was in college. I was an undergraduate at the University of Texas at Austin in the late 1980s and in graduate school at Yale University in the early 90s.
Okay, so we're about exactly the same age. When you were an undergraduate, say, were these dynamics in play? Like, what was the climate, even being a right-of-center person in Austin at that time?
Yeah, exactly. So I was sort of a child of the Reagan Revolution. I was very interested in those ideas, and as an undergraduate, probably more interested in sort of actual politics than I was later. Was involved in some of those kinds of activities and debates as an undergraduate. Austin's a fairly liberal town, but on the other hand, Texas, including University of Texas, relatively conservative place. But even so, among the things I did then was write for a conservative student newspaper, and it was a routine problem for us that left-wing activists would steal all the papers and destroy them.
We did that at my college, too. We would take the, not me personally, but take the, there was one conservative, like a broadsheet. I don't even think there were enough conservatives to make a newspaper or magazine. But yeah, they would literally go like dorm room to dorm room and take all this issue spectator away from people's front doors.
Yeah, it's a pain. It's those were expensive to put together, and the papers got destroyed. We at one point bought newspaper stands, and they were all destroyed and stolen. So we wound up sort of reverting back to what we had done originally, which was just hand them out individually in person, and standing around on the mall handing out conservative papers. Frequently got me yelled at and spat on more than once. Our signs would get torn down, as would signs for other conservative groups on campus and the like. So it's a lot of stuff that actually remains very familiar kinds of low-level harassment that occurs of conservative student groups on college campuses. I sort of took those as annoyances, but sort of par for the course, apparently, as to how these things operated. And I certainly never experienced instances of actual meetings getting disrupted or speakers being shouted down or things like that. So some of these more recent, much more, I think, aggressive and consequential actions do seem new to my experience and more disturbing about what the state of student speech on campus is.
Right. So I'm curious sort of what you see as the timeline, because I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of us who follow these things, we started noticing deplatforming of speakers and just, you know, more sort of extremist activism on campuses like around 2014 or so. But were you starting to notice it earlier? Have you been in academia your whole career?
I have. So I graduated from Yale in 95. I taught for a couple of years at Catholic University of America in DC, and then I've been at Princeton ever since. And so certainly I think, you know, Princeton is relatively good about these things. And so we've had some incidents on our campus, but not a lot, certainly not a lot compared to a lot of other campuses. But I do think there's a definite upsurge of those kinds of problems, you know, and they initially were problems confronting student speech and events that students organized on campuses. And that seems like about the right time frame when we really started seeing more of an uptick of these things. And part of what I was struck by, it's possible that these things were occurring at an earlier point. And people just didn't notice as much. Man, one thing that has also changed relatively recently is everybody has a video recorder in their pocket and ways of publicizing that. And so we're just much more aware of every little incident that occurs on campuses at this point in ways just wouldn't have been true when I was an undergraduate, for example, or certainly even when I began my career, such that you could have speakers being shouted down and just no one would notice except for the people on that campus itself. And so it's really hard, I think, to get much of a handle on how much change has actually occurred over time, just because the data just isn't there to have a good feel for that.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. Well, I want to hear about exactly what the AFA does, but just so our audience has some sense of context, in case there's anyone left who has absolutely no idea what we're talking about, I just want to list a couple of recent or more egregious examples of professors being censored and in many cases suspended or fired. So there was a case from last fall. I think this got a lot of attention. It was Greg Patton at the University of Southern California, who was teaching a language course in Chinese. He was discussing public speaking patterns and the filler words that people use to space out their ideas, like or et cetera. The professor mentioned that the Chinese use a word that is pronounced like nega, N-E-G-A, as a filler word. Okay. And some students reported him to the administration because it sounds like a certain other word, and he was suspended. You know, and it's funny, like, this goes, I'm reminded back in like 1999, remember the Niggardly case?
Yes.
From I can't remember what the university was. Oh no, it wasn't even a university. It was like a government official of some sort, wasn't it?
I think that's right. Yeah. Actually, right. I don't remember the details of it either, but yeah, I think that's right.
Somebody used this is a word that has absolutely nothing to do with the N word. It is spelled N-I-G-G-A-R-D-L-Y. I think it means parsimonious.
Right.
Something like
and,
that.
And it has a different etymology. It comes from a completely different source.
That's right. And that was like a huge brouhaha. But that was back in 1999. So we have been having these sorts of eruptions over misunderstood words. But, you know, this stuff goes on and on and on. Last August, there was a professor at University of Missouri who asked a student where he was from. The student said he was from Wuhan. And I mean, I guess this is a bad joke. The professor said, "Wuhan, well, let me get my mask on." Okay, not a great joke, but he was suspended. The student complained, and the professor, even though he apologized, he was suspended. So, you know, there are, as I'm sure you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of examples of this kind of thing. So like, is it out of this directly that the Academic Freedom Alliance arose?
It is these kinds of incidents, they are, I think, becoming more common, and they come from a lot of different directions. So both of those examples involve students who were offended by things that happened in class, which is, I think, probably becoming more common of students objecting to this, although this has a very long history. The American Association of University Professors was founded in the early 20th century in order to advocate for principles of academic freedom and ultimately to call for a tenure system to protect faculty from being fired. And a lot of their early cases involved similar kinds of things where students would object to what a faculty member was doing in class because they found it offensive, often because it was more conservative student body and the faculty were more liberal. And so students thought the faculty were insufficiently religious, for example, and would object to university administrators and to alumni who would then turn around and fire faculty for that kind of thing. So this is a long problem of offending student sensibilities in the classroom, and we're getting that now. I think the other thing that's becoming very common is faculty saying controversial things in a public forum on social media, for example, and then it going viral, attracting lots of attention and pressure being put on a school to fire the faculty member for having said something controversial on Twitter.
And it's something in a completely non-academic context, by the way, like their private Twitter. They like the wrong tweet, I think, even in one case.
Yeah, in some extreme cases. I mean, and there's a range as to what this looks like. So in some case, right, I mean, these are certainly private Twitter accounts. These are not some kind of official or institutional Twitter account. They're people's private speech in that sense. But some of that private speech is far removed from their academic work and just as a reflection of their personal political opinions, for example. So we recently had a controversy erupt around a scientist, actually I think she's a social scientist, an archaeologist at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, who tweeted some rather unfortunate things celebrating Rush Limbaugh's death, which people took very badly and then called for her to be fired as a consequence of that. That's the kind of thing that's simply a matter of somebody's personal political opinions. They vented on Twitter like many people do, but it comes back to haunt them at their job. In other cases, though, we also see people posting things on social media that are more closely related to their actual scholarly expertise, and sometimes elaborating on that in sort of politically insensitive ways, as often occurs on Twitter, but sometimes being perfectly reasonable in terms of trying to share with the public things they know as a consequence of their expertise. But it turns out the things they know are controversial, and the topics they study are controversial, such that to the extent there's blowback then on those faculty for those kinds of posts, in that case, it's very tied up with the very thing that we're paying them to do as scholars, even though in this context they were expressing it in this sort of private venue. And I think those things are very disconnected then. The possibility somebody might be held to account for sharing in public things that they have scholarly expertise on is somehow separated from maintaining a rich scholarly intellectual environment on a college campus. Just doesn't work, and so we're seeing a lot of these episodes now as well, which really just reflects the rise of social media and how people use it, and the fact that now professors who have long held controversial views of one sort or another now not only express those in the local letter to the newspaper editor or in a local town meeting or at their local bar, but instead they're now expressing it to a global audience on an internet platform. And the result is, in some cases, people actually are fired. In other cases, they're suspended. In many cases, they're being threatened with being fired and suspended as a consequence of those kinds of posts.
I think it's important to note, too, that it's not like this is just coming from very far left progressives. The example that you cited, the professor who was sort of
tweeting in a celebratory way about Rush Limbaugh's death. I'm assuming it was conservative students who came down on her for that.
Well, in this case, it was sort of conservative activists as much as anything. So local state politicians got involved and started calling on the university to fire her. Donald Trump Jr. Was one of the ones who amplified that particular incident. And so there are sort of organized activists on the right who try to make hay from these kind of Twitter posts from faculty on the left. We do see similar kinds of things happening, though, from conservative professors who might post things on social media as well. But it does emphasize that and one reason why the Academic Freedom Alliance was formed in the way that it was formed is this is a pervasive problem that affects everybody across the board politically. It's not that left-wing professors are particularly vulnerable or right-wing professors are particularly vulnerable. I think really at this point, all academics are vulnerable because the attacks are coming from all kinds of directions. And you never know when you might step on a landmine and get blown up.
So tell us how the Academic Freedom Alliance is set up. How is it organized? What does somebody like call you up and say, I need help? Do you function like, you know, the ACLU or something, or how they use it?
So we function a little bit like the early AAUP and somewhat like the ACLU does as well. And that our goal, we are set up initially as a membership organization and of faculty. And so we have brought in a diverse group of founding members to help launch us. And our first commitment is that we will defend the speech rights of those who are members of the organization. And that defense may take the form of public and private statements of support for that individual, in which we try to encourage university leaders to do the right things when these controversies emerge and try to explain to them what we believe the right thing is in these contexts. And then also to provide resources so that those individual faculty member can get legal advice when they are trying to navigate these situations, and if necessary, raise the possibility of litigation in order to vindicate their rights if they wind up being violated by the university. We also anticipate sort of proactively taking on some cases that extend beyond the members. We expect to grow the membership over time, so we become a large organization, encompass a lot more people. Certainly right now, it's a relatively small group, even though, you know, with over 200 people, it's bigger than we initially imagined it might be at this stage. But still a relatively small group, and there are lots of people who are far more vulnerable than the people we've recruited into the organization at this point, people who are adjuncts, people who are just beginning their academic careers, and those people need assistance. And we want to be able to take on those cases and help come to their defense when they need it.
Can you name any recent cases or any cases that are most emblematic of your mission?
Well, at this point, we're mostly just getting started. And so we and in part, this is sort of the fact that we had some ideas that some of us have been kicking around. Mostly some of us at Princeton University had been talking about these kinds of issues and what we might do to help defend these principles more effectively and also help people understand them better than they do now. But we also wound up then eventually gaining access to some donors who were willing to put a little money into it. And as a consequence, started seeming like we could put some of these ideas into practice. It's taken a while just organizationally to get to where we are now. We did, because we had access to the funds even before we really organized, we were able to provide some assistance, for example, to Dorian Abbott, who is a professor at the University of Chicago. Had given a public presentation questioning aspects of affirmative action. And there was a petition that I believe was organized primarily by graduate students to have him dismissed for having given such a presentation. University of Chicago, like Princeton, has a very strong free speech commitments built into their governing documents. And so it seemed like an obvious case to us in which a faculty member was being threatened with violations of contractual rights he had at his particular university. We provided some assistance to him as he sort of navigated that controversy. And as we would expect, quite quickly, the University of Chicago leadership came down quite clearly in saying that, of course, he was protected in what he had said, and he was not going to face any sanction from the university for it, even if some of the students found it controversial.
Yeah, University of Chicago has been a leader, I think, administratively in terms of protecting free speech rights and kind of standing up to students. Although I feel like I heard that that's maybe changing. Did they get a new president? Or what?
They're about to have a new president. Okay. So they are undergoing a administrative change, and you never know what a new president's going to bring. It's Chicago has been extremely good on these issues. It's sort of in keeping with their long-term culture. But the outgoing president had encouraged the formation of a faculty group to draft what became known as the Chicago Statement, committing to a set of really traditional free speech principles that largely mirror American constitutional law. It was drafted by a First Amendment scholar at the Chicago Law School, Jeffrey Stone. Princeton faculty pretty quickly adopted the exact same Chicago Statement, in part in order to incorporate that into our own governing documents, in part in order to encourage a national conversation about the importance of these principles. The Chicago president has been very vocal in defending these ideals, but he's been unusual among American university presidents on that front. Our president at Princeton, Chris Eisgruber, who when he was on the faculty was a First Amendment scholar, he primarily studied religious liberty. He's been very vocal about these issues and has taken a very strong stance about the importance of academic freedom to the operation of universities. But it's really remarkable to me how few university presidents are willing to take that kind of stance in public. A lot of them recognize that those principles are controversial on their own campuses as well as potentially off campuses. And I think far too many university presidents just prefer to avoid that controversy and not talk about it rather than speak up on behalf of what really are very fundamental values to how the university operates.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the obvious question. This is the elephant in the room. I mean, it's so basic. Why aren't these leaders leading? I mean, I think the most, I'm sure you are familiar with the images from Evergreen State College. I think this was back in 2017. I mean, this is a case that gets talked about a lot. I'm sure a lot of listeners of this show are familiar with it. But, you know, in addition to Brett Weinstein, the evolutionary biologist, getting run off of campus by student protesters, George Bridges, who was the president of the college at that time, was effectively held hostage in his own office, right? I mean, student protesters kind of stormed the administrative offices, were sort of engaging him in a struggle session from which he could not escape. I think he had to like ask permission to go to the bathroom or something. I mean, that's obviously a fringe example, but like, what is your diagnosis? What is wrong with these administrators that they can't like act like grownups in the face of a handful of 20-year-olds?
So I wish I knew, because maybe if one had a better understanding of what was going wrong, it'd be easier to fix. It's not entirely clear to me what's going on. I think partially, I do think to some degree, a lot of university presidents assumed the problem wasn't that bad. And they did have a wake-up call with events like Evergreen, events like Charles Murray being shouted down at Middlebury College. I think a lot of universities recognize that that's a bad sign, that it'd be a horrible black eye for their own institution if something like that were to happen at theirs. And so I think some university presidents started to come around to thinking this is important and maybe we should be doing something about it. At the same time, though, I think a lot of university presidents recognize that there's at best, mixed feelings about these principles on college campuses. A lot of students are hostile to it. A lot of the younger faculty in particular are quite hostile to traditional principles of free speech and academic freedom. And I think a lot of university presidents would prefer to keep their heads down and just hope that they don't have an incident on their own campus and so don't want to get distracted from other things they want to accomplish by inviting controversy by talking about it. I think it's a very short-sighted strategy, likely to be ineffective, but I do think a lot of them are just hoping that they can avoid talking about this and it'll just go away on its own. And then when these incidents actually occur, I think they just feel under tremendous pressure to give in to those who would like to suppress speech. And that pressure can come from a lot of directions. To some degree, it can come from students. It can come from some of the faculty. It can come from alumni and donors and politicians and people off campus. I think university presidents feel genuinely threatened by that kind of pressure. I think they sometimes feel that their own job security is on the line when they're trying to navigate those controversies. You know, often the path of least resistance is to throw the individual faculty member under the bus rather than actually stand up and defend them.
In a case like that, would an individual faculty member come to you at the Academic Freedom Alliance and say, help me, advise me? What would the procedure be?
We would hope so. So hopefully some of them will contact us. I think we sometimes will have to contact them if we hear about it either through press reports or through other members calling it to our attention and offer assistance and what assistance we can. I mean, I think there are going to be occasions when the professors involved would prefer to keep a low profile, perhaps not want any outside involvement, particularly. There may be circumstances where they feel like they're already handling the situation well on their own and don't need further assistance. I think others will welcome the help if it's being offered. And so our hope is that we can mobilize in some of these situations in a timely way so we can get involved when we're still pretty early in the controversy. And as a consequence, there may be opportunities to try to head it off and prevent it from getting worse and to help out the faculty members while there's sort of still time to get out of the situation as effectively and efficiently as possible. I do think if you let these things go on, that often the pressures build on universities. You get missteps by the faculty member that can sometimes dig a deeper hole for themselves. And you know, it's ultimately, I think, less effective and meaningful to come in after the fact and condemn a university for having made a bad decision. What's much more effective, I hope, is to intervene early on and try to lead them to make a good decision. And so we would much prefer to be in the business of helping people reach better outcomes in the midst of these controversies rather than find ourselves coming in after the fact and telling people that they misbehaved.
When you say misstep by a faculty member, what does that look like?
So I think it can be various things, including I think it's often a problem if faculty member apologize for what they've done.
Yes.
They come out and sort of issue sort of public or sometimes private
hostage note.
Confessions.
It's
absolutely.
The perfunctory hostage letter.
No, and I think, I think most lawyers would tell you that if you find yourself in these situations, that the more you talk, the worse off you're going to be, right? Whereas faculty, I think their natural instinct is to think they can talk their way out of it, right? And they can make things better if they simply talk about it enough. And of course, to the extent that there are people who seem genuinely upset, you want to, I think, quite naturally make them less upset. And so it's a very human instinct to want to apologize and try to iron out the situation. But one result of that is I think you put yourself in a more fragile position in terms of basically having admitted that you did something wrong. And as a consequence, you're not on as firm of legal grounds as you otherwise would be, whether we're talking about your own particular employment contract or something else.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I know. It always seems to me like people who are trying to navigate this landscape need to like have their own version of Miranda rights. Like, you have the right to remain silent. And in fact, anything you say can and will be used against you, because that's exactly what happens in these situations.
Yeah, one of the things we're sort of in the process of putting together now is actually sort of a set of recommendations to faculty. If you find yourself in this situation, what should you do? So that people, as you say, sort of know their rights and also have some do's and don'ts about what's the best thing to do, even before you might have legal assistance, even before other people are rushing in there to help you out. But even as you're trying to manage this on your own, what are the mistakes you ought to avoid? What are the things you can do positively that would actually improve your situation? And I think people need those advice. I mean, we're in this very unfortunate environment, right? This is not something when I started my academic career, I thought I would ever need to know, right? What would I need to do if a mob was howling for my job? But unfortunately, that's the situation we're in. People are, in fact, getting harassed and getting threatened, and they need advice then about how best to deal with that. And that can take lots of different forms in terms of what that looks like. So it might take the form of the kind of case I mentioned with Dorian Abbott, in which students are petitioning the university to fire you. But it may also take the form of you're getting death threats on your voicemail, on your office phone, and so there's a wide range of trouble people can find themselves in that all stem from they're simply exercising their speech rights as faculty members, so there's no one size fits all, I think, as to how best to respond to those situations, but when those controversies arise, most faculty are pretty unfamiliar with them. They are very unexpected. They don't know what they ought to be doing. They're taken aback by as far outside their normal routines about what academic life has looked like to them up to that moment. Knowing that they're not alone, knowing that there are people willing to offer advice and assistance, can be just extraordinarily helpful in helping them navigate that kind of situation.
I want to emphasize again that this is not something that's happening solely among people on the left. I mean, it gets very delicious to constantly talk about these examples, far left student activists coming down on perfectly liberal,
right.
Very far left in their day professors. But, as you mentioned earlier, this does happen on the right, whether it's people in government or state officials or, just right-leaning people on campuses trying to censure people on the left. But do you have a sense, I don't know if you actually have data, but like what proportion of these cases have to do with people, leftists censoring people not as left as them? Is it a lot more?
It's a sizable number. The data on this is not great in general. Some people have tried to collect data on these incidents, which mostly relies on media reports of what's happened. And frankly, there's a lot of these kinds of incidents where there are no media reports and no one really knows besides maybe the people most immediately involved. So all the data we have is pretty imperfect. But I think the best data we have suggests that conservative faculty are disproportionately affected by these. They're a pretty tiny percentage of the overall professoriate, and yet they do take up a larger percentage of those who are being harassed and threatened in various ways. But that means still a very sizable number and an absolute majority probably of the faculty who face these kinds of events are from the left themselves. And sometimes right. They're confronting often on-campus groups that are further to their left, but sometimes they're facing off-campus groups that are from the political right.
Oh, okay. I wonder too if you are a professor who considers yourself on the left and then other leftists are attacking you, if you're more likely to react in a way that is going to not work in your favor ultimately. I mean, the essence of cancel culture always like you get canceled by your own side,
I think that's right. I do think the temptation is much stronger when it's seemingly your own side that's complaining. And so it's easier to imagine that you can mollify them. It's easier to imagine that you ought to because it's easy to think that they are being reasonable in some sense, and that their offense is genuine, and you can respond to it in a way that will make things better. I think it's often easier to assume that's not true if you're being attacked from the other end of the ideological divide, where maybe you imagine the attacks are less reasonable, you imagine there's less you can do to respond to it effectively, and so maybe there's more of a temptation to dig in those circumstances rather than apologize. I think it may also depend some on what the nature of the group is that's coming to attack you. And so I think almost all professors are going to have some instinct to think that if students are the ones attacking them, that they ought to try to make that better with and deal with the students as such, right? That you, I don't think any of us want to be offending the students. We all think that we're trying to educate and build a good relationship with the students. And so I suspect almost regardless of the particular ideology of either the students involved or the faculty involved, there's going to be a real temptation that if the problem you're confronting is a bunch of angry students, that you're going to be trying to apologize to them, try to mend fences as best you can. That's like
or reason with them. Try to have a dialogue. Well,
always that possibility as well. No, exactly right. Whereas I think the instinct's probably going to be different if instead what it is a Twitter mob that's being organized against you, and really it's the university president who's getting lots of angry phone calls from outside groups complaining about you. I suspect faculty, regardless of their own ideology, are probably less likely to think, okay, the thing I ought to do in these circumstances is go out and explain myself or apologize or something like that. And so it probably depends a little bit on how close you are to the people that are attacking you, not only ideologically, but also just in terms of your relationship to them on the campus community and professionally as to what your natural instincts are as to how to respond to these kind of events.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure people who go into academia, people who become professors, especially in the humanities, they would just be more likely to have a temperament that was about engagement, right? Rather than just avoidance.
Sure. No, that's the natural instinct, I think, in general, right? I mean, it's certainly for academics. I mean, it's one thing about both forming this group and as I've been sort of doing other things on this kind of topic is there's an element of being a natural optimist if you're an academic, in that you sort of assume that if you can reason with somebody, you can persuade them and you can lead them to better conclusions than they start with, and you can lead them to be more sophisticated about what they're doing. And so you always assume there's sort of an opportunity for education and persuasion, no matter how much experience suggests maybe that's not true. And that sort of is what leads you into this profession. It's sort of the heart and soul of the profession. And so it is going to be a very natural instinct to want to reason with people, even though they might be screaming at you.
Well, and on that, I mean, we have this idea that this is limited to humanities departments. I mean, we see these kind of situations playing out, English departments, I guess, political science. But, you know, are we seeing this in engineering programs, business schools? Like, is that starting to change?
I do think it's starting to change.
English,
yeah, there was certainly majors. A time, I think, when faculty on other parts of campus might look across at the humanities and social sciences and think, boy, you people have a problem. But fortunately, it has nothing to do with me because none of this affects what's happening on my side of campus. I think a lot of people are getting a wake-up call on that front now. I think people in the sciences and in other sort of professional school settings, business schools, law schools, medical schools, are all starting to realize that these same kinds of conflicts can arise in their own parts of campus as well. And we're seeing more and more of these kind of cases arising in other parts of campus. And so people are starting to come around and recognize that they've got a problem also. They have a stake in what the solution looks like also. We brought people in particular from the sciences we've been trying to bring into the group. In part, sciences work differently than the rest of academia. The issues are not only the topics subject-wise different, but sort of how they operate professionally is somewhat different. And so their experiences of these things are a little distinctive and unique, and it's useful to have people with real experience in labs and the like and how they operate in order to really appreciate what these conflicts look like. But we've had a fair number of people from the sciences reaching out and recognizing they have problems and appreciating a group like this. Law schools at one point seemed sort of immune from some of these conflicts. Law schools are, after all, where you're trying to teach students to listen to people who disagree with you and argue reasonably about things that are often very controversial and difficult.
Think like lawyers.
So think like lawyers.
As a matter of fact.
But increasingly, lawyers are law schools are having more and more of these troubles as well. And so we have a fair number of law professors in the group, in part because they are naturally sympathetic to these principles, but also because they are seeing in their own law schools that this is becoming an increasing problem for them as well.
Right. I noticed that you have Janet Hawley on your board. She's one of the Harvard law professors who's been outspoken about federal overreach around sexual assault adjudication procedures as they were laid out under Title IX. Do issues in that sort of realm fold into what you're doing at all? I mean, we're talking about, you know, sort of curriculum, but just in terms of people feeling sort of unsafe, violated, uncomfortable. How does that play into what you're doing?
Well, we're trying to keep our mission fairly narrow so that we're focused on academic and free speech issues. There certainly are a lot of other issues surrounding academia that deserve attention, but we're hoping not to drift off into them, including things like Title IX issues and what kinds of procedural protections faculty ought to have under those circumstances. But it's also true that there's probably not a impermeable barrier between these things. So I think increasingly we're seeing instances in which Title IX proceedings are being weaponized to use against faculty that you disagree with politically. And so charges get filed. The procedures are often not very good. Faculty are being harassed through these mechanisms. But it's all just a pretext for the fact that people don't like what it is you're saying. So we may be drawn into some kinds of cases involving Title IX proceedings, for example. They're certainly somewhat related sets of issues, but we are trying to keep our focus as much as possible on free speech as such.
I want to just talk with you about free speech more broadly. You wrote a book about free speech. This is very much your wheelhouse. Are you a free speech absolutist? What does that mean to you?
So I am a little skeptical that anyone is a free speech absolutist. And I often have a hard time even understanding what people mean when they say it. I'm teaching a seminar now, an undergraduate seminar on free speech and the law. And one of my starting points is if you actually pay attention to the law, the American constitutional law surrounding free speech, it's quite obvious that there are no absolutes here. There's all kinds of exceptions that we have long recognized to what people say and circumstances in which people can be legally punished for what they say. American constitutional law is distinctive in that those are pretty small categories. And so we try to limit as much as possible the ways in which people can be punished for things they say in order to create as much space as possible for people to speak out. But for some people, I think that by itself just is a form of absolutism, just to say, well, really what we're talking about is very robust protections. But even those very robust protections in the American constitutional law of context, for example, are not absolute. If you libel somebody, you can still get in legal trouble. If you threaten somebody, you can still get in legal trouble. If you harass somebody, you can still get in legal trouble. There are things you can say, things you can do with words in which you can be held legally to account. And likewise, on university campuses, there are things you can say that quite properly can lead you to be sanctioned by your employer. And moreover, that includes stuff that's not just a function of being illegal under a general statute or running into the boundaries of First Amendment law, but reflect the boundaries of academic freedom itself. So, for example, when I'm teaching in a classroom, part of what I'm supposed to be doing is teaching the subject matter, not teaching irrelevant things. And so if an engineering professor walks into class and dedicates his class to talking about the 2020 presidential election, he's behaving in an unprofessional manner and can be reasonably sanctioned by his university for using that captive audience to do things that are inappropriate for the context. Likewise, if an engineering professor walks in the classroom and conveys to the students professionally incompetent knowledge about engineering, he can likewise be held liable for.
Oh, that's a good point. I never thought of that. Sort of like malpractice.
Yeah, absolutely, right. And so, in some ways, the speech that faculty have in some context is definitely more limited than what we think about from the First Amendment context. From a First Amendment context, I can hold any kind of opinion I want, no matter how misguided or stupid that opinion might be. But we expect professors to actually be experts in some things. And so walking into your classroom, trying to publish in your scholarship things that are wholly misguided from a professional perspective, it's just an indication of professional incompetence. And universities, quite rightly, have an interest in trying to weed out people who are professionally incompetent rather than protect them.
And how is it that professors with tenure are they actually being fired? Like, how are they getting around this?
In some cases, although it is true that faculty who are not yet tenured are far more vulnerable than tenured faculty are. We certainly see examples of adjunct faculty who are on semester by semester contracts, course by course contracts, who sometimes are fired in the midst of a semester and yanked out of a classroom in a class that they're teaching mid-semester because of something that they said that was controversial and people found objectionable for one reason or another. More common than that, though, and far more difficult to deal with, are instances in which people's contracts simply are not renewed. And so they're just told, sorry, we don't have any courses for you next semester. And the real reason is because you did something controversial that we don't like. But universities don't need to say that. And it's hard to pin down that that's actually what's going on. Tenured faculty can be sanctioned in various ways, but it is much more difficult to do it. So they have more procedural protections. It's easier to imagine filing a lawsuit to vindicate your rights if you're fired unjustly with tenure. So tenure is an important part of how you protect academic freedom and speech rights for faculty ultimately. But an awful lot of faculty don't have it. And as a consequence, they're more vulnerable than those who do.
Right. Increasingly, they're relying on adjuncts and untenured contract faculty. And the thing is that people are being very unimaginative in their curriculum. I mean, I remember having a conversation with an English professor at a big state university. And he said that he used to teach Lolita and he wouldn't even bother anymore. And his exact words were, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of that. I mean, it's a faculty coming to conclusion that the likelihood of there being some controversy and some pushback or some kind of backlash to their teaching is too great. And so you make choices about how you teach, what you teach, in order to avoid those potential controversies. And you see it all across the university where people are constantly sort of thinking about the syllabus and what readings they're assigning, what topics they're covering, and starting to think about, okay, what's the worst case scenario here? What might students object to? And is it worth it to teach this particular item. If the result is that students are going to threaten me, they're going to be yelling, I'm going to get a lot of bad press, it's going to eat up, at the very least, it's going to eat up my semester, and I'm going to spend all my time and energy worrying about this, even if it doesn't result in my getting fired or something. And you know, it's not hard to think about what kind of dramatic effects that might have on what actual education looks like, that there are books you don't teach in English classes simply because students might react badly to them and people think it's safer not to bother teaching them. There are topics you don't discuss in philosophy because they're going to be too controversial. Some students might object. And it may raise difficulties for you.
Like, what would that be? What would be a topic in philosophy that?
Well, philosophy at the moment is currently being riled by debates about identity of various sorts. And so there are debates about gender identity. There are debates about racial identity, sexual identity that are philosophically interesting and important, but obviously touch on social issues that are controversial and things that students find that they have deep feelings about. That can create real difficulties for the philosophy classroom, but also has consequences for scholarship. There's ongoing battles now about what people can and can't publish and what kinds of conferences people can and can't hold, talking about transgender issues, for example, it seems to be roiling philosophy much more than it is other disciplines, in particular, in part because I think there's still more disagreement in philosophy and some people who are still more willing to take on the conventional wisdom or what is has become conventional wisdom.
The other disciplines have been totally captured.
Yeah, I mean, if you're certainly in the women's studies departments, those are not live
gender,
issues.
Gender studies. Yeah. There's no women's studies anymore.
Well, that's
gender,
increasingly gender right. Studies. So yes. Yeah, or sexuality studies and the likes, they vary. But it's but you know, and certainly in some disciplines, there's such a consensus on these issues that you don't even get much debate. Philosophy is an area in which they're sort of congenitally more likely to argue with each other than might be true in some other disciplines. And there is still more disagreement about some of these issues. And so it's still a live fight. That might not be true in the not too distant future. But for now, I think that's where a lot of those particular battles are taking place.
Oh, you're right. I never thought of it. You always hear about these things coming out of philosophy departments, like the English departments and the anthropology and the sociology. They've given up. The train has left the station.
I think that's right. I mean, some of them, it may be less likely they encounter some of those issues. But for a lot of them, these are issues that are important to philosophical questions and philosophical inquiries that you would reasonably engage in. And it's still the case that there's division among philosophers about how to think about them. So you have both those kinds of problems in academia, though, of self-censorship, where people are afraid to say things, and so they don't. And that can affect their scholarship, it can affect their teaching, it can affect all kinds of aspects of what they do. And you have just a homogeneity of views in academia in which there's just not widespread disagreement about a lot of things that in larger society there is disagreement about. And as a consequence, a lot of things just don't get talked about very much because everybody's on the same page.
I mean, this flattening of the curriculum, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because if the students don't learn how to engage with the material on any sort of multidimensional level, they will continue to not be able to engage with it. Like, you stop teaching it and it is going to remain unteachable. It's antithetical to the educational mission.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it can be challenging to get students to take material seriously that they disagree with so vehemently and that they're not used to. But that's an important challenge. You still have to get them to engage it, I think, because otherwise you do have exactly this problem, right? Of students who never encounter things they disagree with. As a consequence, they don't understand what the issues are, and they're not capable of engaging seriously with people they disagree with, or with ideas that they disagree with. And so they either shut down in the face of it, or they react very passionately to try to end the debate. And what you want instead in academia is to actually challenge students, force them to think about hard ideas, force them to actually defend their arguments and defend their instincts on certain issues. But that's often a painful process. Students often don't really want to do that. It can be unpleasant from their perspective to be challenged on things that they fundamentally believe in. And so they push back. And I think we're in an environment now where that pushback can be quite severe, and it can be great enough and that faculty think it's not worth inviting it. And moreover, we're in a situation now where when the students push back, the faculty will not rally around the professors that are trying to put that challenging material in front of
students. Publicly, they won't. Sometimes they'll privately.
Sometimes privately, but that's part of what leads people then to say, okay, well, it's just not worth it, right? Because they know that if students push back, no one's going to be in their corner helping to defend them on this. They're going to be all by themselves, taking all the flack for it. And so it's easy to imagine that, you know, look, that's just not worth having that fight. I can be doing something else instead. And one thing we hope to do as an organization is in part to emphasize to faculty, look, you're not all alone. You're not by yourself on these issues. And sometimes these are fights and conversations and debates worth having.
Yeah, I want to talk to you for a minute here about how this plays out in the world of deplatforming speakers. I mean, I assume that, you know, your organization, it's not here for, you know, comedians aren't going to run to you and say, well, you know, I got booed off the stage at Oberlin. Right. But, you know, one of the things that always frustrated me about campus speakers over the last, you know, decade or so is that the conservatives coming to the campuses were like really bad examples. You know, they were the provocateurs. There was Ben Shapiro, and back in the day, it was Milo Yiannopoulos. Why weren't more serious conservative speakers being brought in? Is it because the student groups who were making the decisions just wanted the low-hanging fruit? Or like, what do you make of that?
I certainly agree that I think we had a lot of conservative speakers in particular who were particularly provocative, not intellectually all that interesting, and so not doing much to advance the larger discourse on campus. But, you know, frankly, you get the same thing on the left. And partly that does reflect the fact that students like being provocative. It's the nature of people 18 to 22 or so that
they want to be entertained.
They want to be entertained. Yeah. Partially they want to resist those around them. And so I think for conservative students, for example, often feel like a beleaguered minority on college campuses and certainly in lots of places. Inviting somebody like Milo to campus is sometimes a way of sticking a thumb in the eye of all the people that are giving them grief all through the rest of the academic year. And so there's a certain attraction in being provocative, especially when you're an embattled minority. I think it's also true that some of those kind of speakers had a lot of organization and money behind them. And so there were concerted efforts to get them into college campuses. And so for students looking to have an outside speaker to come to campus, these were often presented as freebies. Somebody else was going to pay to bring Milo to campus. And so why not? Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily a student's fault. That's a fault of outside activists who preferred to fund those kind of speakers and bring them to campus rather than funding other speakers who are more reasonable. I'm afraid also that on the political right, we've had a bit of a decline in the quality of intellectuals and public speakers who are on these circuits. You know, when I was an undergraduate in the 1980s, we would have conservative speakers who would come to campus, and they were controversial because they debated controversial things and they took controversial positions, but they were serious people with serious ideas and they were capable of debating and arguing about them. And they were coming to campus precisely in order to present those ideas and defend them. And you would lose something if you didn't actually listen to them and try to learn from them. And we still certainly have some people who are like that, who come to college campuses from the right. But I do think they're sort of being overshadowed by other kinds of speakers, and they may not be as prominent or as many of them as there once were. I think one virtue of a place like Princeton on this front, besides the fact that we're fairly good about encouraging a larger free speech environment and emphasizing students what the expectations are about what we do here on a college campus, we also have a conservative center, the James Madison program, that brings in outside speakers of uniformly high quality. And so they aren't the provocative entertainers that students sometimes want to see, but they're serious people with serious ideas who are willing to articulate them and defend them and can't simply be dismissed. And one virtue of that is it does emphasize to people, look, there are such things as conservatives right. with actual ideas they're willing to talk about. And you can have actual conversations with them and learn something from them. And if we had more of that happening on college campuses in general, so that students across the political spectrum could look around and say, oh, well, you know, actually, there are smart, interesting conservatives I could actually learn from, even though I disagree with. That would be very useful. But instead, for the most part, they don't see that. And so for them, conservatives are often sort of scary, ridiculous figures they don't have to take seriously.
I mean, like with what happened with Charles Murray at Middlebury, I mean, that's a case where you wonder if the students had a wider bandwidth in terms of what they could receive or process about a conservative speaker, if their context was something other than Ben Shapiro, they might be able to sort of understand who Charles Murray was in all his, he contains multitudes. I mean, this is right. a guy, you know, yes, he's known for probably, you know, I think it was like one sentence in the book, the Bell Curve, which was actually Richard Herrnstein's fault, his co-author who, did him the disservice of dying before the book came out. But I'm not a Charles Murray apologist or anything, but you know, he's a guy that was a champion of universal basic income before anybody was talking about it. And so like, that's the kind of detail that I wonder if those students would even be able to hear, because they have put him in the Ben Shapiro bucket really unfairly.
Right. It's part of what I found very frustrating about the Charles Murray incident at Middlebury. It was the fact that these are students, for the most part, who admitted that they had never actually read any of Murray's work.
Well, they wouldn't. Are you kidding? They couldn't.
They objected to is old work, right? They're reacting to what they heard about the Bell Curve, not that they would actually read the Bell Curve themselves, and had no interest in hearing what Murray was talking about then, which was economic inequality and polarization in America, right? Exactly themes, in fact, they probably are pretty sympathetic to if they would actually sit down and listen to it. But we have this sort of culture, I think, that has formed on college campuses, which is really unfortunate, of just thinking some people become taboo because of something that they said once. And so it doesn't matter what they're talking about now. It doesn't matter what they're writing. You're never allowed to read or talk to or listen to these people ever again, because at one point, sometime, they might have said something that puts them on a blacklist. And it's just extraordinarily anti-intellectual and unhelpful for what it is we ought to be trying to accomplish more generally. And the Middlebury incident really seemed to sort of highlight the fact that this is a pervasive feature of culture on too many campuses. And it's not unique to the Murray situation, in which there's all kinds of people who effectively find themselves sidelined because you're just not allowed to talk to them or engage them anymore because they once said something that somebody regards as problematic.
What do you think of someone like Jordan Peterson? Okay, here's a guy who is a provocateur, but he's also got some pretty serious, interesting things to say. But he pushes the boundaries in the interest of making a making his point or something.
Yeah, no, my sense is, I'm certainly no Jordan Peterson expert, but my sense is he's serious about ideas. He's willing to talk about ideas. He does certainly push some boundaries. He's sometimes provocative in his presentation, but he also is appealing to a lot of students who are intrigued by those ideas, intrigued by his presentation of those ideas. And so, unlike somebody like Milo, who I think just doesn't have any ideas to offer and really isn't attempting to present them, somebody like Jordan Peterson is offering some serious ideas and is worth engaging. So it seems like a perfectly reasonable kind of person to be bringing to campuses precisely because he demonstrates what it is we want from campus speakers, somebody that's willing to talk to students in ways they find interesting, is willing to present interesting and sometimes provocative ideas. Their ideas worth thinking about, even if their ideas you wind up rejecting or modifying or qualifying in various ways in the long run. But he's another one, of course, that is just shouted down and excluded from lots of places.
Well, and he appeared on the radar, on the mainstream radar, under the banner of free speech. He was talking about compelled speech. So this was a bill up in Canada that would have required people to use the preferred pronouns of non-gender conforming people. And his whole premise was that he would use the pronouns that people preferred, but he would not be compelled to do so. So how do you, as a free speech scholar, sort of metabolize that?
I think it is a difficult issue. I have found myself a little befuddled by those who regard this as a serious compelled speech issue. If you're willing to recognize the pronouns that the person wants to use in this context, it's not obvious to me why it's a deep problem to insist that you use them. It often strikes me as people who sort of make these sort of extravagant refusals to use the pronouns people want to use are mostly just being rude in doing so and not being particularly helpful. And the free speech issues at stake seem relatively modest to me, but I don't think they're totally inconsequential. And in some contexts, they may actually be more significant. It is true that more broadly, part of what I've been frustrated by with sort of the a lot of figures on the right, from Jordan Peterson to Milo to various other people, is wanting to sort of grab the free speech cover for what they're doing more generally and try to wrap themselves around in that banner, sometimes quite justifiably, because in fact their free speech is being suppressed in various ways, and they quite reasonably want to appeal to free speech principles in order to protect their interests on that front. But sometimes the free speech label, I think, is just used as a way of excusing pretty bad behavior. And so I think one thing I did not fully appreciate when I first started speaking about these things and talking to students about these things is the extent to which the current generation of students, for example, when they are thinking about people asserting free speech rights, they're often thinking about internet trolls harassing people. And when you call them on it, they say, well, I've got free speech. And so it becomes just the cover by which people want to engage in bad and annoying behavior,
right.
Rather than and it denudes it of any sort of principled purpose ultimately. And so for a lot of students, it's not obvious why anyone would value such a thing as free speech if this is what we mean by it. And so I find myself very frustrated by some of the people who I think are primarily just trying to get a rise out of people and trying to provide cover for their own rudeness by trying to wrap themselves in the free speech banner to the exclusion of of one, any recognition of sort of what better behavior would look like and what's actually more conducive of creating a better intellectual environment, but also to the exclusion of trying to think about what it is free speech is for more generally and why we actually care about these principles.
Yeah, and of course the internet provides an enormous canvas for saying all these things that we weren't contending with 30 years ago. That kind of brings me to my last question, just as we sort of wrap things up here, looping back to where we started. So you and I are the same generation. I mean, we grew up, I think, you know, it was just a truism that freedom of speech was important. It wasn't a partisan issue. It was just what it meant, part of what it meant to be an American. You know, and I think we kind of just ran around saying what we wanted to. Partly, you know, we didn't have Twitter. We were saying what we wanted to a limited audience most of the time. So I think it was a pretty simple concept. I don't know if you have children or you have young people in your life or, you know, in your family, do you find that they have a different concept of speech than you do? And is it something that you talk with them about?
I do. So I have a college age daughter. And so, yes, she is. So she is sort of right smack in this demographic that I'm attempting to persuade ought to care about free speech.
Is she embarrassed of you? Will she not walk next to you on the sidewalk because of all this?
Well, of course, that's true of all teenage daughters, isn't it? So there's certainly elements of being embarrassed by me. There's elements where she's been much more fearful of my safety than I've been. And so where she sort of imagines, wait, you're going to go in and talk about free speech and to that audience, they're going to kill you. And I think I think it reflects the sort of experience she has of recognizing just how polarizing this topic is and how in some ways unthinking the rejection of it is. When you're talking at this point, when you're talking to undergraduate audiences about free speech, you're often talking to a hostile audience about why these things are valuable. And so I start with that premise and I start by trying to explain, look, here's why you ought to care about this. No matter what kind of preconceptions you might have about it, these are things that might actually matter. And one thing about students, young people of that age, right, that they have a very short time horizon they're working with. And so their context in which they're thinking about, well, who claims free speech rights? What does free speech mean? In what context is it being deployed? Is a very narrow one and a very specific one. And so they often are thinking about, well, the people who care about free speech appear to be internet trolls and neo-Nazis. Yeah. So to some degree, it's important to sort of try to convey to them, well, you know, it was the case that other people actually cared about free speech too, and it was really important to other political causes. And try to explain why it is we actually came to have this kind of robust set of principles and why it actually matters and why they should have a stake in it, even if they're sometimes unhappy with particular individuals and their claims about free speech. Yeah, it's also true, I think, there's a lot of truth in what you just said about sort of the time when we were growing up and what this looked like in the 80s, for example. But I think I would also caution against ever thinking there was a golden age about these things. It's easy to think that at some point everyone was fully committed to free speech and we've fallen away from that.
Oh yeah, no, we had Tipper Gore putting labels on heavy metal records.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was coming from the right. I mean, that's what, yes. I've had students shocked that it was ever the right wing that were being the purity police.
Absolutely.
Like, it's completely flipped.
It's bizarre the extent to which it is flipped, but that's absolutely right. I mean, what I try to convey to students in part is, look, it was like yesterday that the political right accepted the idea that free speech was good. And like up until then, they were the ones who were trying to suppress and censor people. And it was the left that was aggressively trying to defend freedom of speech and expanding it for their own protections. And yeah, in part, I tend to find that students just find it incomprehensible to imagine anyone would want to suppress speech on the left, for example, such that would actually need protection against being suppressed.
And right.
Yeah, and again, it's one of these, which was, when I first started going around giving talks on this. One thing that was sort of convenient is I should have pointed the Trump administration and say, look, we have a sitting president who probably is not very sympathetic to a lot of the kind of speech and causes you care about. Is it really the case you would want him to be more empowered to be able to suppress speech he disagreed with? But there's just so much that they took for granted about what's on the table and what's not on the table in terms of what might get suppressed. It's sort of a failure of imagination, right? And you need to get them to appreciate that there is a broader vulnerability here. And that's the reason why we need to protect these as universal principles in the first place. And it's the same with the Academic Freedom Alliance. As part of what I think makes this work now is that we are now in a situation in which faculty across the board can look around and say, look, this isn't somebody else's problem. This is actually my problem, that my speech is vulnerable. My situation might get threatened because of something I say. And as a consequence, now I need to actually worry about this and be part of a broader coalition trying to defend these principles. I find it an encouraging sign that we have a lot of faculty who are willing to do that. It's possible to build those bridges and find that common ground. It gives me a little optimism that will also ultimately be true as we think about sort of the younger people, the current students, for example, that will also be possible to persuade them that they too have a stake in this and they ought to come around to trying to defend free speech rather than just suppress it when they don't like it.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for speaking with me about all of this on The Unspeakable. Is there anything that you want us to know going out here, how people can reach you or anything we failed to touch on?
Yeah, I really appreciate your having me. So I can be found on Twitter at K.E. Whittington. The Academic Freedom Alliance can be found online, both website and it has its own Twitter feed as well. And we are very welcoming of inquiries about what it is we're up to and offers to help us as we get going.
Okay. Well, congratulations with the project and best of luck.
Thank you very much.
That was my interview with Keith Whittington, chair of the recently launched Academic Freedom Alliance. Keith is a professor of politics at Princeton University. He writes about American constitutional law, politics and history, and American political thought. He is the author of several books, including Speak Freely: Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech. You can find the Academic Freedom Alliance at www.academicfreedom.org. You've been listening to the Unspeakable podcast, which you can hear on all the usual podcast places, as well as the show's website, theunspeakablepodcast.com. To help support the show, please subscribe at patreon.com/theunspeakable. This week, Thursday, April 1st, from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, I will be on Clubhouse, the social media app, talking with Angel Eduardo, who was my very popular guest on the March 7th edition of the podcast. We'll be continuing our conversation. If you're on Clubhouse, please drop into our room, which is called The Unspeakable is a Post-Identity World Possible. Again, that's this Thursday, April 1st, from 8 to 9:30 p.m. I think in the intro I didn't specify, it's p.m. We're not doing this in the morning, don't worry. In the meantime, I hope you'll join me next week for another super nuanced, unspeakable guest. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.